Anthony Ha, and I'm here with...
I'm Brian Heater.
And this is the Original Content Podcast. We're going to be doing things a little differently today. First of all, you may have noticed that Daryl Etherington is not with us. He is in Japan, I think.
Yeah, I think he... it's a pretty good excuse to not be on a podcast.
Yeah, he... Well, the thing is, he never says, I'm in Japan. He says, I'm on Japan time, which seems like it, you know... opens up a lot of possibilities there.
Yeah, that could be taken all sorts of fun ways.
Yes. So what we're going to do, as always, is recap the week's streaming news. And then instead of doing a review, we were hoping to review Stranger Things. But A, Netflix did not get back to us. And B, Brian has not seen the first season of Stranger Things. So instead, we're going to be talking about some of our streaming...
best films of Winona Ryder.
Just going to be talking
Heathers,
about...
Edward Scissorhands.
Beetlejuice.
Really the Tim Burton canon.
Star Trek 2009.
Obviously. Yes. And Alien 3.
I do like it. No, Alien
Resur- 4.
Alien Resur- yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. Yeah. No, 3 was the Fincher one. 4 was the one where...
Right.
With the,
right. Both bad.
Sigourney Weaver.
They're both bad.
Bad for very different reasons, though.
Right. So we're not...
We'll not be talking about that.
I mean, it might come up, but yeah. The plan, at least, is to do some of our recommendations for fun Halloween movies that you can watch on Netflix and other streaming services. But first of all, I think most of our readers probably know, Brian, you are the hardware editor of TechCrunch, but they may not know that you also have your own podcast.
I like that you say most of our readers like know as though anyone has any clue as far as what I actually do.
I mean, no one...
Because I find that as far as talking to other members of our staff, nobody knows my title.
That's fair.
For what it's worth.
So some people may or may not be aware that you work at TechCrunch, but you also have a podcast.
I do. Most people know me from my little listen to podcast, RIYL, through the Boing Boing Network.
Tell us a little bit. What do you do for RIYL?
So the very microphones that we are currently using to record this, I've recorded about 240-odd episodes, and it's really just long-form interviews with a lot of musicians, cartoonists, writers. An upcoming episode in the very near future is with a porn star. So, again, hedging my bets.
That's what media in 2017 is all about.
Yeah.
The one thing I've always wanted to ask you, by which I mean for the one... or 2 years that I've known you.
I thought you've been for the 1 or 2 minutes that we've been recording.
No, about your podcast is you do not have introductions in your podcast. Like what we're doing now, you don't do. You just jump straight into the interview. Why do you do that? Is that because you're lazy?
So, believe it or not, that was actually a conscious decision on my part. I started doing the show for two reasons. One of them was I really just missed being a DJ. I was the station manager at the radio station KZSC in Santa Cruz. So I was there for 4 years doing that. And after a while, I really started to miss it. And the other reason was because I end up doing a lot of interviews for, for this site, for my day job. And then on the side, I do a lot of coverage of sort of cartoonists and musicians, things like that. And, you know, it's... especially working in print media, you end up having these really long, in-depth, engaging conversations with people that take 45 minutes to an hour, and then you end up having to cut that down into 500 words. And it's a little bit heartbreaking. It's what they call in writing killing your darlings. Because, some things just aren't going to be relevant to that specific conversation. And I've been doing podcasting since pretty close to the beginning of podcasting for a lot of different outlets. And so I realized it was a good opportunity to do that. And the way in which most people consume podcasts are either really short, so like 5 minutes. I also do a 5-minute podcast with my friend Timmy from The Whitest Kids from time to time. And then I do this hour-long one because a lot of people are, at the gym or on the subway doing their commute. And I was listening around to a lot of shows, and I realized that when people talk about specific shows, like, for example, Marc Maron, who's been on the show a few times, the thing that they always tell you is that they fast forward through the first 5 minutes of the conversation because he's just sort of in there, kvetching in his garage, talking about himself, and people are waiting to really get into the meat of the interview. So I thought, hey, let's just start with that. Let's just cut out all the fat. And honestly, the way that I usually have these conversations anyway is I sit down with somebody, I start talking to them, and then at some point I hit record. So it's really sort of getting rid of that preamble. And the idea is, you know, if you're listening to the show, you're listening because you like the show and you listen to week to week or because you like the person. And if you need any additional contextual information on that person, A, it's all in the show notes, and B, really easy to find on Bing.com now.
All right. So if you are skipping the first 5 minutes of this show, you can maybe start now because we are going to start recapping the week's streaming news.
You can't tell people what portion to skip in the beginning.
I can tell them. I don't have to expect them to listen.
I'm just saying you can't retcon that.
Oh, that's true. Well, I'm going to start talking about the news anyway because I want to hide my shame. So the first thing I should probably say that I think a big part of what's been happening this week is Hollywood is still dealing with the fallout of the Harvey Weinstein scandal. And so I don't think there's a lot kind of happening news-wise. And that's like, it's just, and we've talked about it in depth in some of the last few episodes. So I kind of figured we'd kind of take a break from it this week.
So you said, let's get two guys in front of microphones and really dig into this sexual harassment scandal that's plaguing Hollywood.
That's what we did for the last couple of weeks. And I figured, you know, people probably wanted another week of that, but I wanted to swerve. I wanted to go in a different direction.
Let's talk about another spooky topic.
Bloomberg Business Week ran this story about Apple's plans in Hollywood. It wasn't necessarily like any big revelations, but it was sort of this big picture look at how I think people are really excited because it's Apple, but at the same time, nothing super interesting has come out of it so far, and that it turns out that maybe what they're planning is less exciting than what people had hoped for, which is maybe like the next HBO. Maybe one place to start that is just, so they've launched Planet of the Apps and Carpool Karaoke. Brian, you've seen Carpool Karaoke?
I've seen and reviewed Carpool Karaoke. I could not bring myself to watch Planet of the Apps.
I think that's fair. How would you characterize Carpool Karaoke?
Well, as America's number one James Corden, I couldn't even finish that thought without laughing.
I don't understand why we only have people who dislike James Corden on this. Like, Daryl hates James Corden, too.
James Corden, I feel similarly about James Corden as I do Jimmy Fallon.
Okay, I think that's unfair.
I feel like they're two very similar characters in that I don't think either one is a great comedian. And I think they both rely on a lot of gimmicks. Neither one is particularly funny. Now, granted, like most of my so-called interactions with James Corden had been through things like Carpool Karaoke and seeing that bubble up. But it's kind of like the memification of comedy in that, you know, this sort of like groundbreaking comedy that people are sharing around the internet is literally just like people sitting in a car and singing along to a song.
Right. Well, and that it's also interesting the first or second time, but
theoretically,
might be that if you're being generous, it's interesting the first few times, but then they have to do it again and again and again, and then maybe then now you know trying to do a whole show with it.
Yeah, of turning what is ostensibly like a 2 to 3 minute long bit inside of a larger show into its own program, and they, I think I only watched like the first or two episodes to, you know, in order to maintain my sanity. But, you know, they're trying to throw in other things. Will Smith was on an early one. And honestly, like, if you can have Will Smith in something and you can't just ride on the charm of Will Smith alone, something like this, like, that's pretty, I think it's a pretty big problem.
Says the man who has not seen Suicide Squad.
I think it's possible. I think it's but again, when the show, like, literally, you know, this isn't Suicide Squad. Well, maybe in a sense it is, but it's not.
It's 2017's Suicide Squad.
What's that movie, like Collateral Hope or something that came out?
Oh, I know what you mean. Collateral Beauty.
Collateral Beauty. I mean, the man is very capable of making very terrible films, and in fact, I would say that probably applies to most of his work. But he's one of those people who is just so charming that in a show like this, when it's based entirely around charm, you think that would be enough to sort of carry it through the 22 odd minutes that it is. But, you know, they've got the titular Carpool Karaoke segment, and then they come around and do pranks. It's one of those shows where it's really obvious that they're trying to fill this amount of space, so they're just like jamming all of these different reality show concepts into one, and there's not a lot to like about it.
Right. So one of the things that they talk about in this Business Week article is the fact that the show was actually delayed because Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, wanted to remove basically any of the risque content, including references to vaginal hygiene is the phrase that Business Week uses. Not in quotes, so I don't know if that's actually what he said, but essentially that's what was... Do you think that the show might have been better with more vaginal hygiene?
I think... How do I term this? I'm pro vaginal hygiene. I think it's ironic if you're trying to remove the quote unquote filth from a show, and vaginal hygiene is one of those things that you're taking out. No, I don't think it would have been better if they had like played it blue at all. I just think it's a really bad idea for the show. I think if you do like James Corden, he probably works in pretty small doses. It's a very, very thin soup, and it's not something that you can carry over 22 minutes. And I don't think that that would have helped it at all. The fact that this, and I'm sure you're going to get this, but the fact that this and Planet of the Apps, which is basically like Shark Tank or any one of those shows, but turned on its head, and that it specifically is about apps, those are just two really bad premises for a show and not something that I at all would hang the hat of my growing content company on.
Right. I think one of the things that's been strange is for years now we keep reading these stories about how Apple is going to be this huge player in content.
From a fiscal standpoint, that's absolutely right. I saw a story a while ago and it was, I want to say it was like $3 billion they were planning on spending in the first year.
I think it's $2
billion. Yeah.
But in the billions of dollars, certainly.
Yeah.
And that they were like bidding for James Bond. And I think in some ways they
would... Wait, is James Corden going to be the next Bond? Are you breaking news on the show?
James Corden has been cast as the next James Bond, then the last James Bond.
Yeah, they're just going to blow up the franchise after that.
But I think it's weird that, you know, given that there was so much excitement about it, they came out of the... I mean, and I understand that I think to some extent they probably like us to not think of Carpool Karaoke and Planet of the Apps is like part of they're going to make some sort of big push in the next year or two, and hopefully maybe with some big show like the new reboot of Amazing Stories or something like that. But like, then why release, like, come out with these shows? Like, it just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's really hard to launch a content platform. I assume it'll be some sort of subscription base, something like Netflix or with what they've done with Apple Music. But, you know, look, if you look at Netflix and Amazon Prime, certainly Hulu, these are all services that were built on existing content. The whole original content concept came a lot later. But because there's that precedent, you can't really do that now, right? People are sort of expecting you to come out of the gate with something new and original and something that really, again, is going to convince people that they need to spend either an additional $9.99 or however much a month, or dump one of those existing services. So they've been trickling it out a little bit. They've been, I think, playing around with different platforms and things like that. You know, they did a couple documentary series through Apple Music. There was like a Green Day documentary. I mean, I think that that's an interesting idea. I think that's a interesting way to enhance an existing platform. But certainly nobody that I know is signing up for Apple Music or any of these services to watch a 22-minute version of Carpool Karaoke.
That's right. I think that if that's actually why you're signing up, we want to hear from you because you are a very strange person.
Are you willing to turn over an entire episode to that person?
Like a whole, like four episodes.
Yeah.
Like
an arc.
Yeah, a whole thing. Well, so we should probably move on to our next story, which is about Netflix. And Netflix, it's already been talking about how it plans to spend, I think, $7 to $8 billion on original content next year. It's a lot of money. And to finance that, they're actually raising $1.6 billion in debt. I think fundraising stories, even these really big fundraising stories, are not necessarily, you know, there's the kind of speaks for itself. But I do think it points to just the fact that like how ambitious and how much freaking money Netflix is planning to spend.
Yeah. If you can remember back to A, when they really sort of launched a streaming service, and B, when they started doing original content, I think there was a lot of doubt around that model, you know, because because of the tremendous amount of money they were spending, it just didn't really seem to add up. You know, again, they're slowly bleeding people dry at $10 a month. But obviously they've had a lot of success. I will say that I don't think that there's much of a correlation between the amount of money that they spend on a program and A, how successful it is, or B, how good it is. If you look at, like, it was Marco Polo, I think.
Marco Polo, yes.
That was, I mean, I've heard pretty good things about the Get Down, but it certainly wasn't like their
and it's
biggest show.
Right, and it's been canceled.
Yeah. You know, a lot of the really big successes that they've been having are kind of the surprise ones. I mean, nobody saw Stranger Things coming, right?
Right. No one saw Stranger Things. Like, BoJack Horseman has sort of, like, over the years turned into this, like, you know, I mean, again, they don't release viewer numbers, but what seems like a pretty, like, a cult success.
I know you guys talked about this on a past episode, but can I tell you how much I love Big Mouth?
Oh yeah, Big Mouth is really good.
I thought that was a really wonderful show. I was not expecting to like. I mean, I love Nick Kroll,
right?
And I like Jason Mantzoukas. A lot of people that are on the show, but holy hell, like, that thing really sidelines you, because you're like, oh, this is a gross show, and then you're like, oh no, this is like one of the most thoughtful and heartwarming shows that are around right now. This is dealing with, like, some really interesting things in a very interesting way.
Yeah, that it's definitely very filthy.
So filthy.
But that it's genuinely interested in sort of just how confusing and crazy it is to be a child, like, becoming an adult and going through those, like, changes. And then, of course, it turns out that when you're an adult, it's not actually that much better, but we don't have to get into that now.
But I think that's a good example. I mean, you're right with BoJack and again, Stranger Things. I'm blanking on other ones off the top of my head, but these are like, I think that to me is the real appeal of a service like Netflix, where, okay, you know, they've got some big-ish name movies. You know, you can go on there and watch Jaws, for example, but it's kind of the modern equivalent of channel flipping. And maybe you get lucky and you come across something that you've never heard of, and it turns out to be your new favorite thing.
Yeah, I think there is. I agree that in some ways that is in the same way that I think I can remember growing up, and then, like, especially at, like, you know, 11, 12 or 1 a.m. when I probably should have been finishing my homework, and you just, like, stumble on something amazing, and you're like, oh my God.
That's how I found Mr. Show for the first time. We had HBO, and I was, like, flipping through the channels, and I'm like, what is this? And it changed me as a human being. So blame Bob and David for what's sitting in front of you.
So, and I think that there is something about, like, Netflix, to just when something, which I don't really even think you get on any other streaming services, because I just don't think they have the same library of content, and they don't have the sort of randomness of the algorithm.
UI, I mean, Amazon's gotten a little better, but Amazon's UI has been so bad.
Right. And so with Netflix, you're much more likely to just be like, hey, what's in science fiction? What's in horror? And you're like, what the heck is this? And then, I mean, I think it depends on, like, I think I for a while felt like the average content quality was so bad that I wouldn't just click on something, but it would make you curious and you go Google it, and then if it sounded interesting, you'd go check it out. But I agree that is to almost certainly what channel surfing is going to look like in the future, and looks like for most of us, a lot of us now.
It's a sign of what a good job they've done with original content and with It's a sign of the good job they've done with original content and some of these deals that they've struck, and just sort of acquiring existing movies, that we forget how bad it was early on.
Right. And I think, I mean, especially on the movie side, people still come. No, I think it used to be just crap movies, and now it's, they don't, I mean, they have a couple of high profile deals where big budget movies are on the service, especially the Disney movies, for a few months, and then they disappear.
Yeah.
But
is that deal dead, by the way?
It will be when the Disney service launches in 2019. Okay. So, makes sense.
Did you notice that Rogue One went up, but The Force Awakens was never on there?
Yeah, they said that the deal started at the beginning of 2016, so Force Awakens just missed that cutoff.
Yeah, and I guess I guess all the older Star Wars are still under Fox control, or are they?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
So,
that's right.
So those won't come to the service unless they strike a deal with 20th Century Fox.
Yeah, I think that'll be a while before that happens. But Yeah, so let's talk about the final piece
frontier.
Of news. The final frontier.
That would be space.
Space, which is the final frontier.
These are the voyages of the Star Trek Discovery.
Yes, so Star Trek Discovery, which is on CBS All Access, has been renewed for a second season.
Congratulations, Anthony.
Yes, I think I did it single-handedly. We reviewed it on original content. I wrote a review of it for TechCrunch. I think we can safely say that without me, this show, I mean, might not even exist.
People were like, Star Trek? What is this thing?
That's right. I assume, Brian, you have not watched it.
I have not watched it.
It's good. I don't. So how you're not a big Trekkie Trekker yourself?
No, I'm a very small Trekkie Trekker. In fact, I would have said Trekkie had you not corrected it and said Trekkie.
I actually am comfortable with Trekkie. I think like when I was growing up, like when it was a little bit. People were a little more sensitive. I think there was a certain kind of Star Trek fan.
When people were still like in the shadows.
Yeah, and so you'd say like Trekkie. It was like the thing of like would you say sci-fi? Would you say SF or science fiction? And like if you said Trekkie or if you said sci-fi, then you weren't like a serious enough fan. And
I think it's important to point out now that Star Wars is a space opera.
So I think one of the reasons it's worth talking about Star Trek Discovery, besides just the fact that I love Star Trek, is the fact that it's basically like the marquee show for this new streaming service, CBS All Access. And so this is a sign that like CBS deciding to launch this show. And what is by, you know, all accounts, a pretty expensive show. I mean, not like a Star Wars or Marvel level budget, but a big budget TV show. And just have it basically all behind this paywall. It seems like they're pretty happy with how it's going.
I'm shocked that they didn't hang their hat on Young Sheldon.
Well, that one I think is, that's a little bit more of a casual fan base,
if
I would
imagine.
If
the bottom falls out on Star Trek, you think they'll hedge their bets on the Big Bang spinoff?
Because the other show they have is they have a spinoff of The Good Wife called The Good Fight.
That's a rough name. I have not gotten around to The Good Wife, which I think is still on Netflix, and I've heard nothing but good things.
Yeah, I've heard really good things, and I mean,
neither of us can actually speak to its.
No, I mean the other interesting thing about Discovery though is actually that so it's on CBS All Access in the U.S., but All Access only exists in the United States, and so part of the reason that the finances work out is because Netflix carries Star Trek Discovery in every other country, and apparently that deal alone has essentially financed the show. So I mean, it may be that it doesn't even matter how it's doing on All Access, as long as like Netflix continues to pay for the international rights, that helps to finance the show.
Netflix is so much better in every other country. Have you traveled abroad and used Netflix?
I have, although I think it's better in the sense that the weird things will pop up that are like,
well, weird things, but it's much better in the television sense. And I didn't realize this. I think it was like covering IFA in Berlin one year, and I was sitting in my hotel room, and German TV is pretty rough. So I was watching Netflix, and you know, they had like Better Call Saul up to the moment and Fargo. They just like all of the American TV shows just go over there immediately.
Yeah, although I think that's some of that is that I think they had a specific deal with AMC where I think those shows, maybe not immediately, but AMC would basically, as soon as the season ended, they would put like that season on Netflix
on
right
away. Or FX?
Not Fargo. But like Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad before that. And I think they have that deal now with the CW where the shows are definitely not quite AMC quality, but also have a devoted fan base.
Is Young Sheldon the Better Call Saul to the Big Bang Theory's Breaking Bad, or is it more of a Muppet Baby situation?
I don't know that there's really a distinction. I think it's kind of a...
I mean, we talked about retconning before. We touched on it briefly. You know, Muppet Babies was a spinoff of The Muppets Take Manhattan, wherein there's a dream sequence where Piggy wonders what things would have been like if they'd known each other when they were young. Ergo, it does not have to stick to that strict Muppet canon.
Wow. Are you being serious right now? Is that real?
Yeah.
That I can't believe that's true.
It's absolutely true, and it's been very important to my fanfic work.
Right, but although I mean your fanfic is it strict canon?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, that's fair.
But there's Muppet Babies canon and regular Muppet canon, so I've got a little bit of wiggle room there.
Yeah. So Brian, I want to wrap this up, but before we do, I want to ask. what would it take for you to subscribe to CBS All Access?
I can't name you. I mean, I've never seen an episode of The Big Bang Theory. We've discussed my thoughts on Star Trek. I'm kind of more of a J.J. Abrams fan.
Right, that's horrible.
Yeah, yeah. I like Star Trek when it hedges towards Star Wars territory, but you know, I subscribe. I obviously have a Netflix subscription, and I have Amazon insofar as like I use their shipping, and it's nice to have free video on top of that. But I can't see myself subscribing to another service at this point.
Yeah,
especially not CBS.
I mean, I'll be real. Like, as soon as Discovery is over, I'm canceling my subscription, and then when the second season starts, I may start it up again. May or may not.
I did a story about this like a couple months back about this kind of fragmentation of all these services, and it's nothing new in that they've been trying it for a long time, but at one point all of the different channels realized that no one was going to subscribe to them specifically, and that's why Hulu exists right now. But now it's sort of getting back to that point where, you know, every channel wants you to pay $5 to $10 a month just to get their own service, and in just about every case, that seems crazy to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and this is, you know, no offense to CBS, although I'm sure they might take offense anyway, is definitely, to me as a fan, the best case scenario is that CBS All Access fails, and then Discovery moves, like, it becomes available on Netflix in the U.S.
I want to back up a second. No offense to CBS, but I hope you fail.
Right.
It's the most offensive thing you could have said.
I hope that this specific online offering fails. I hope that as a content producer and TV channel, you continue to flourish and maybe continue to make this show, but basically just make Discovery available on Netflix is my point.
I'm going to ask you a question, and nobody cares about the answer to this, but is Paramount just films?
They're just films. I don't know the exact nature of the deal, but essentially CBS is TV, Paramount is films for Star Trek, partly because Star Trek has been around for 51 years now. It was originally produced by Desilu, aired on NBC. Yeah,
that's Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz's.
Yeah, and so there's been this sort of complicated corporate history where, like, who owns, you know, the rights. I think has changed a couple times. And
wouldn't it have been great to have Lucy on Star Trek?
Maybe.
I think it would have been pretty.
It would have been interesting. Maybe that would have led to like a third, fourth, and
I think she makes everything better, but a good
third season and then a fourth and fifth season. Who knows?
I was gonna say she makes everything better, but those last couple of series she had were pretty rough.
How many episodes of I Love Lucy have you seen?
Oh, I mean, it was on Nick at Night for a long time. I've seen. I don't know how many they had. I don't know how many seasons it ran. I know that, like, The Honeymooners famously was like 20 episodes or something like Star Trek. But I've seen a pretty healthy dose of I Love Lucy.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it seems like that's like one thing that maybe hasn't gone away, but definitely changes in sort of an on-demand world, is the show that everybody just watches because it's the one of the three things that's on at like 3 p.m. in the afternoon for like decades.
That was a really good show.
Maybe I haven't seen I haven't seen it in like 20 years. But
speaking of, just a little plug for streaming services. The Dick Van Dyke Show just came to Netflix.
Oh wow!
FYI.
All right.
Mary Tyler Moore, Dick Van Dyke.
I'm probably more interested in Mary Tyler Moore than Dick Van Dyke.
Well, you know, Carl Reiner created the show and was only in the pilot episode
of Dick Van Dyke.
I mean, it wasn't called the Dick Van Dyke Show because he was the Dick Van Petrie. Rob Petrie played that character.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, that's
cool.
Pretty good digression.
All right. So let's talk about Hollywood. I mean, not Halloween. Halloween. And so Brian and I both brought a couple of different recommendations for things that are, I mean, basically all on Netflix, not because we're all just Netflix shills, but because that's where we kind of found the most interesting stuff. Also because neither of us subscribes to Shudder, which is the horror movie service, which I am actually thinking about checking out.
I don't know if my last one might only be on Amazon Prime.
Okay, there we go.
Well, it's a two-parter. One of them is on Netflix.
Okay. So I guess I'll start.
How is that for a teaser? Get people excited.
What could it be? What could it be?
It's transparent.
Great show. So the first movie I wanted to talk about was It Follows, which is on Netflix. Have you seen It Follows?
I haven't. This is the STI-based horror movie.
Yes, essentially. It's a really hard movie to explain, but I'm going to try.
So the, you, I let me preface this by saying that people can go to twitter.com. What's your handle?
Anthony Ha.
Anthony Ha. It's a good one, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And look at a list that you did a couple weeks ago where somebody asked you about the best horror movies. I think you picked 10. One of them, there was a glaring omission, and it is one that I'm going to talk about at the end of this program, but It Follows was, were both of these on there?
No, It Follows was on there, and it was probably the only movie of the 21st century that I put on there. Although we'll be talking about, one of the other movies on that list in a little bit as well. But so It Follows is a movie that came out, I think, 2016, and it...
Both of your movies came out in 2016, right?
Raw came out in 2017, I want to say. They're both basically movies from the last couple of years. And It Follows is about the idea that you basically have something inside you that like is attracting this shape-shifting killing monster
called gonorrhea.
And the only way you can get rid of it is by having sex with someone else, and then you pass
or penicillin.
not in this case, unfortunately. You've got to you actually have to have sex with someone else, and then they and then basically the monster comes from them. And then the way that it's set up early in the movie is that this monster is not particularly smart, is not particularly fast, but it will never stop, and it can take any form, and all it wants to do is reach you and kill you.
So it sounds like an attraction, and part of that is because it's shape-shifting, but do you see it at all?
You always see it. I mean, it in the form of one of these shapes, and so like one of the things you start doing, it in some ways it almost works like one of these found footage movies where you're looking for very small spooky things to happen. Is there are specific shots which, and this is a movie that has a lot of these sort of longer shots where you just, there's something happening in the foreground, and then you start to wonder, hey, what's happening in the background there? Is that thing coming towards us, the thing, or is it something else? And sometimes, you know, it goes either way.
Is this allegory?
So it's similar to a lot of horror movies where there's obviously a lot of sexual subtext and like political subtext. And I think if you read it in sort of the most direct way, then it obviously seems a little kind of anti-sex. But I think... I don't know. I think to me it's interesting just as like this idea about the inevitability of death and just that this thing is just like the monster, I think, is just like just this really, really scary idea of a monster because it just is just completely, you know, cannot be persuaded, cannot be escaped. You just have to, you know, you just have to accept its existence and then try to like do what you can to mitigate. Although I had a friend of mine who saw it with me and he definitely was one of the... So it's the kind of movie where if you can give yourself over and just like fall into the mood and just of this mood of like intense dread, it's great. If you think too much about it, it starts to get a little bit wonky because my, you know, it's like, what if you flew to the other side of the world and had somebody, sex with somebody there?
It's basically, I was hoping we'd be able to bring this up. It's basically that scene in Gremlins 2 where they're all sitting in the control room and Billy's a character's name, right?
Billy, yeah.
Billy comes in and is trying to explain it to them and they're like, well, what if the gremlin goes through a time zone.
Right. It's one of those things that if you think about it too much, it probably doesn't hold up. But just as this idea of this thing is coming to get you, it's really good. It also has this score by this composer called Disasterpiece, and it's this amazing synth score. I think the opening scene of the movie is on YouTube, and you should just go check it out. And I'll link to it in the post. But it's it's just like this crazy like synth score that is just sometimes like very dreamy, and sometimes is like in full horror movie mode.
Vangelis-y.
Better than Vangelis.
What?
Yes. Yes.
How
yes.
Dare you.
Brian, what is your first recommendation?
My first one is, I'm probably cheating a little bit on both of these because neither is pure horror genre.
That's all right. It's a good Halloween watch.
Yeah. Well, the thing about An American Werewolf in London is that it's a lot more of a horror movie than you probably remember because it's Jonathan Landis, the guy
right.
who directed Animal House. And you know, looking back on it, you know, you think it's a little bit goofy, and there are funny moments in it, but it's a really dark and scary movie. It's got really great effects. It's a really good horror movie. It's not a spoiler if it happens in the first 5 minutes.
I think, yeah.
One of the main characters is like brutally murdered, and then kind of comes back as a zombie. I think that there's actually similar themes to a movie like It Follows, in that there are sort of these themes about, and you see this a lot in vampire movies as well, these themes about sort of like responsibility. I mean, I don't think, like, the way you're describing It Follows, it doesn't sound like it's anti-sex so much as being anti-safe sex. And, you know, sort of like the idea of this passing this thing along is basically like passing the burden on to somebody else without telling them. And this is sort of similar. He's kind of grappling with the idea of the fact that he's basically a killing machine.
Right. I mean, that's an interesting thing about, like, werewolf movies in general. I mean, I don't think they're actually, well, basically this and The Wolfman, which is that they're from the point of view of somebody who's been turned into a werewolf.
You described all the werewolf movies.
That's basically
both of the werewolf
movies. The two big
there
ones.
Might be that Jack Nicholson one.
Oh, yeah, Wolf, yeah. Wolf,
yeah.
But that it's, so, I mean, I think, without getting too deep into spoilers for these incredibly old movies, I mean, I think they sort of end in similar ways too. I mean, the werewolf movie kind of has this kind of formula, and it sounds like, I actually have not seen American Werewolf.
It's great. It really is great.
And but my sense is that it kind of, I mean, it follows and in some ways reestablishes that formula.
Yeah, it's fun to obviously play with these old horror movie tropes, and again, like I said, the vampire genre does this a little bit, because, you know, you will, when you move past like Nosferatu or Count Dracula, you're dealing with people who need to feed on other people in order to survive, and there's like a pretty inherent moral grappling you have to do. And, you know, the difference between the werewolf mythology and the vampire mythology is, you know, being a werewolf is basically like being the Incredible Hulk, right?
Right.
Like, you know, you have this really destructive part of you and you have absolutely no control over it. You know, that moon comes out and you basically lose complete control. By the way, I don't know if this is on streaming, but what is the name of that movie? What We Do in Shadows?
What We Do in the Shadows, yeah.
Yeah, is also highly, highly recommended. But that's a straight up comedy.
Right, right. But, and yes, and that is directed by Taika Waititi, who's directing Thor, Ragnarok, which,
spoiler alert,
is co-stars the Hulk. So there, yeah, you go. It all ties together.
Are you allowed to say that you're seeing that tonight?
I'm seeing it tonight. So by the time this episode goes up, I will have seen it, but I cannot tell you what I think because I haven't seen it as we're recording.
I'm excited for you. That movie was great. Wilder People, I watched on a plane, but it was wonderful.
Yeah, Wilder People made me cry. I also watched it on a plane, yeah, and it made me cry. I mean, a lot of movies make me cry. I'm kind of a sucker for...
I heard you're more prone to cry on a plane, and it has something to do with altitude, or maybe people just tell
that
themselves
that. That might be true, yeah.
The only time I remember crying at a movie, or at least coming really close to crying at a movie, it was... I'm getting sad thinking about it. I was... I had just graduated... Well, no, I was just moving to New York from California, and the movie My Dog Skip...
I don't know that one.
It's with Frankie Muniz and,
oh, okay,
it's,
yeah,
like a little dog. And the last shot of the movie, I swear to God, the last shot of the movie is him moving off to college and just this like old dog sitting on his bed. Got me.
Oh.
Really got me. And I'm thinking about it, and I'm welling up a little bit.
Oh.
See, I have,
wow,
feelings.
All right. Before this gets any more emotional, I'll make my other recommendation, which is for a French film called Raw, also on Netflix. And that is about this girl who goes off to veterinary school, and her sister is, her older sister is already a student there. And basically through the hazing process, she's a vegetarian, but she ends up eating raw meat. And for reasons that are never really explained, and I think that's fine, she basically becomes... I mean, there's a little bit of explanation. She basically becomes increasingly like crazy and cannibalistic, and like obsessed with blood. And yeah, really crazy. It's one of those movies that the big point of publicity when it was coming out was that people who saw it at the Cannes Film Festival fainted. And so I thought it was going to be like really, really gory, and it's not. I mean, it's just like, it's very uncomfortable the whole time.
People at Cannes probably faint pretty.
Yeah, there is one specific sequence that is horrifying. Like, it is like, I screamed in the theater. It was a lot. It's one of those movies because it's so new, and because a lot of the plot, it's pretty surprising, I think. I don't want to talk about it too much, but if you want an uncomfortable French cannibal horror movie that's not super gory, I would highly recommend Raw.
This is top five uncomfortable French cannibal movies.
At least top 10, at least.
Did she become a killer? Well, she's not. It sounds like she's not like a killer.
No, it's not. No, I mean, it's certainly for most of the movie, that's not what's going. It's more that you start, you're like, what's going on with you?
And how did you hear about? I've never heard of this film.
It played at the Alamo Draft House, okay. And before it did, they were showing trailers for it. I think they actually showed it, in New York, and then in some of the other art house theaters, and then they would just do this trailer, which was just like wordless shots of this incredibly pale looking girl, her face like smeared with blood, and then critics blurbs about how it's one of the most intense movies ever made, and how not for the faint of heart. And then I was like, all right, I got to go see it.
Yeah, they are starting to do some more interesting things with trailers, it seems. The Mother,
yes.
So that one really, I wouldn't say it was a good one, but it was an interesting trailer.
Yeah, although I think there was that was part of the problem, is it maybe, have you seen Mother?
I haven't yet.
Yeah.
It didn't sell the movie at all.
But it seems like it didn't sell the movie, but then the people it sold the movie to, they hated, it like didn't match up with what they expected when they saw the trailer.
It's Aronofsky?
Yeah, Aronofsky, but it was like legendary for being one of the few movies that's got like an F cinema score, which is basically based on these surveys they do on opening night.
Yeah.
And it's like sort of as a measure of how much of the people, of the regular, the quote unquote regular people who see the movie, what do they think of it? And there's like only a handful of movies that have ever gotten an F, because if you go to see the movie, presumably you're kind of...
And they're all by Darren Aronofsky. I bet kind Pi of didn't do to test.
I think F was. I mean, sorry, Pi was one of the other Fs, or at least is. Yeah, in that kind of same
scene where he's like literally digging into his skull.
I've only seen Pi once, and I was like, I think drunk and possibly high as well. So
yeah, saw Pi High.
Pi High, which is also how I saw Requiem for a Dream. I think maybe Black Swan is the only Aronofsky film I've seen sober.
In the same way that I was saying it's hard to make a show like Carpool Karaoke that stars Will Smith and have it not be charming, similarly, a thing that has Jennifer Lawrence, who just objectively is one of our most charming stars, and have it test that poorly is...
Yeah, it's surprising. But I haven't seen it. But it makes me curious. Actually, it reminds me of there was this a few years ago, this New York Times Magazine profile of James Shamus, who was like for a long time ran Focus Features, and one of the things he said was if he always preferred to get an A cinema score, but if he couldn't get an A, he'd rather get a C or a D than a B, because a B just means everyone's just like meh, versus like he would rather get just strong reactions of one kind or another.
But an F is too strong.
I think it's just also like unheard of. Like they're really like there are only like 5 films that have ever gotten an F.
Yeah. You get like an incomplete
and you just you have to go see it again. I think it's also because especially when you first come out, if you've like paid money to see it, you're just kind of convinced, well, that wasn't that bad.
Though?
No, I haven't,
you
seen,
haven't
it.
Seen it.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, because you weren't high.
I was not. When the time comes. Brian, what's your other recommendation?
So it's a two-parter. So it's Room 237 and The Shining, both of which are films that you can watch on streaming services. I know Room 237 for sure is on Amazon Prime, and The Shining is definitely on Netflix.
No, it was on Netflix. It's left Netflix.
Oh no!
So this is actually an you can't.
Yeah.
Let me
put it this way: if you haven't seen The Shining already, you're a bad person.
I have never seen The Shining.
You're a bad person.
I did just read the novel though.
Yeah, the book and the movie are in the way that in the way that good adaptations of Stephen King are, they're very different, to a point where Stephen King basically disowned the movie.
Right.
But I'm not going to recommend The Shining again, because I assume that all good people have watched it. This was, as I said before, when you made that list of the 10 best horror movies, this was the one that was really glaringly absent.
Right, because I think for a lot of people, they think it's the greatest horror movie of all time.
It's. I mean, you like Stanley Kubrick, right?
I do. I think it took me a while to come around to him, because there are so many stories about an insane perfectionist he was, and he sounds such an asshole.
Yeah.
But then, I 2001 is one of my favorite movies of all time.
Yeah, I mean, my ex refused to watch it because of basically what he did, the psychological abuse he put Shelley Duvall through the film. But again, I'm not recommending The Shining because you've already seen it because you're a good person. But I'm recommending Room 237, which is a documentary about The Shining, but it is not a documentary about the making of The Shining. It is a documentary about people's... Can I swear?
Yeah, swear.
It's a documentary about people's completely batshit crazy theories about The Shining, which, you know, you probably know a lot of them. The fact that... I mean, this is not a conspiracy theory. This is the truth. Obviously, that Stanley Kubrick faked the moon landing, and that... I don't know if it was because he's such a clever person or if he just felt this tremendous sense of guilt at doing it, but apparently,
or a little bit of both,
he puts clues throughout the movie, like the fact that Danny's wearing a sweater with a rocket ship on it, which is clearly trying to point people in the direction of his faking the moon landing. So it follows, like, it's been a couple of years since I've seen it, but it follows four or five of these conspiracy theorists, and they basically talk you through about all of these like things that Stanley Kubrick, who by all accounts, like, I mean, he was a perfectionist, but also did put a lot of clues and other bizarre things in the movie, and they've like formed these different narratives and explores all of those.
Right. Well, because I mean, one of the explanations I've read is just simply that he understood that a lot of things, if they didn't make sense, like if you shot in a way where the window is like in the wall, but then you come to the other side and there's no window. Yeah, continue and like things like that. If they registered sort of subconsciously, that would actually just make you more uncomfortable and tense. So it's not that he was necessarily trying to, convey any sort of broader message, but more just like to really freak you out. But now everyone's, or at least a certain subset of fans, are just trying to read some really interesting things into it.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, it is also a batshit. The Shining is a batshit crazy movie. It's like,
I wouldn't know because I'm not a good person.
You're not a good person, but you have watched Twin Peaks and you watched some David Lynch, and it walks that line of how much of this was just put in because it's aesthetically interesting or would be a good plot point in a movie, and how much of this is actually part of that larger narrative. I mean, this was the struggle that I went through in recent months watching the 18 part Twin Peaks return for.
I still have two episodes to go, so don't spoil it for me. Actually, I do. I know what happens.
Yeah. Yeah, David Lynch kind of spoiled that ending for himself, but it's that whole thing of you know, I don't know if there is a through line. I don't know if there's a larger story through here. I'm going to try to kind of connect the dots myself. You know, the movie was named after room 237 in the film, which is the room that they're not supposed to go in, where all the shit is going down, and there's just a lot of weird imagery. There's like a In The Shining, there's a shot of a guy in a old dog or a bear costume who appears to be performing sex acts on an old man. Like, there's all these just sort of...
That's actually from the book.
Oh, yeah, you're right. That is... Okay, so yeah, I guess that's fair. There is, like...
I'm sure there's a lot of it that's not.
I guess that's a good point. I mean, there is a larger mythology, obviously, that is explained in the book. But yeah, I mean, Stanley Kubrick really just... At some point, he threw the book away and just went in his own direction.
Yeah. So I guess we're almost out of time here, but I think we also had a joint recommendation, which is for the movie Hellraiser.
Oh.
Did we? Or is it my recommendation that you were comfortable talking about?
No. You're right. This was the same ex who would not watch The Shining. For some reason, I hadn't watched Hellraiser. Was one of those movies to me where when I was a kid going into the video shop, like, it might as well have been what is that movie with the little like creatures that like pop out of the toilet?
Oh, Ghoulies.
Ghoulies. Yeah, it might as well have been. It just looked like sort of a really bad cheesy 80s horror movie. And she was trying to convince me that like, no, this is like, I don't know if I quite buy into this, but it was telling me that it was like a feminist horror film.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly, it's playing with a lot of, I mean, because it's very consciously a bit like playing with the idea of like the evil stepmother and like,
and there's
the prince,
there's definitely more on her part, at least there's more kind of empowerment
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely an interesting movie from a gender perspective. I don't know if I'd call it feminist, but I, you know, I guess you could make that argument.
I enjoyed it, but it's one of those movies that you watch and like a David Lynch film or a lot of Stanley Kubrick's work, where you watch it and you're just like I guess this doesn't apply to Blade Runner, because Blade Runner kind of, both of them tanked at the box office, but it's one of those things where you're like, I don't understand how this appealed to a mass audience.
Or also, why did anyone think this would appeal to a mass audience?
And by all accounts, like the first one at least, like was like this huge success by insofar as like the budget versus the amount.
Right. Okay. So my understanding is, so the first one was like sort of, you know, probably medium budget for a horror movie, which means it was a low budget movie.
They shot it in England, which is probably budgetary constraints.
Right. Well, they shot it in England and then they dubbed over everyone's voices with American accents, which is very unsettling, because if you watch it now and you try to figure out where it takes place, you'll just go completely insane.
Yeah, and I think there are some like rando British people in there too. It just does not make any sense.
Right, because then you're like, oh, maybe it's just in the U.S. But then there's a few things that make you think it's in England. So it's very
It is weirdly
confusing.
Transatlantic in that sense. And also, I think all the other ones took place in the U.S., right?
Yes. And so after that, because that's the only one that's written and directed by Clive Barker.
The third one is definitely in New York.
Yes.
It's basically like in Chelsea.
Right. And then the fourth one, which is probably of, so I think both of us have seen the first four, which were the four that released in theaters. They did like another six on
DVD. So Clive Barker wrote and directed the first one, and I think for a few of them he at least consulted on stories.
Yes, and like that his friend Pete Atkins wrote 2 through 4. And I think each one is probably worse than the one before it.
And was 3 or 4 the last one in theaters?
Four.
Four.
And 4 was actually an Alan Smithy film. But
explain what that means.
So Alan Smithy is basically, if you are a director who feel like the project was basically taken out of your control and you weren't happy with the results, you have a right to basically put the name Alan Smithy on it to register your dissatisfaction and to basically say, I disown this film. Which you definitely wonder, like, what was the good version? like this movie was never going to be like a masterpiece, or even probably as good as the first Hellraiser, because
it seems to me a lot of those Alan Smithy films are really just cash grabs for people who want to get a job and make the film, and they didn't expect it to be better.
Yeah. So I guess very quickly we should say the plot of Hellraiser is about these the Cenobites, which are these like, you know, demons who like feel that there's like no divide. They're really interested in exploring like the divide between pain and pleasure, and that they basically don't think there is one. It's an S&M movie, and that's why you have Pinhead, who has like the pins driven into his head, into his skull, as if you know, because that also like brings him pleasure. And but in the fourth one, you get to see like both, like there's three different time periods: the present, which is to say the late 90s, the past, like the 1700s,
still living in the late 90s.
Yeah, and then there's a part that takes place in space, which is I don't think there's any good, I mean there are good horror movies in space, like Alien, basically Alien. But any horror franchise,
Event Horizon,
it's all right. But any horror franchise that moves into space it generally doesn't do well.
Like the Leprechaun.
Yeah. But I would say don't watch the fourth Hellraiser, which is Hellraiser Bloodline, but go onto YouTube and like just find like a video, like a compilation of all of Pinhead's best lines, because he actually has a lot of really good lines of dialogue. It's just the rest of the movie around it are really bad. Like at one point he, like very close to the end, he just like looks at the hero and he says, "I am so exquisitely empty," which is like the gothest thing to say in the world.
I don't know if this series benefited, like they go into him, his character, a lot more than like, you know, like a Freddy or Jason movie. I mean, like they'll give you like a little bit of background, but like he really becomes that main character, and like you like learn like a lot more about his psychology, and you see him before he becomes Pinhead. And I don't know if the series benefited from that, but clearly, you know, he was the only person who kept returning to the movie. The daughter is in the first two, and I think returns for 4. For like a cameo?
I think a cameo maybe I think a cameo in 3.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you know, she was the only person who agreed to, or he was the only person who agreed to keep doing the movie, so they're like, well, let's really
I think that's, and it's also just he had such a great look, because I mean in the original Hellraiser, one of the things Clive Barker does like talk about is like that the Cenobites are really only in it for like 10 minutes.
So great though.
Yeah, and they're so good.
Chompy
and that
guy and in fact lady.
And in fact if you watch the credits, he's not credited as Pinhead, he's just credited as lead Cenobite, because they're just like, here's some cool looking monsters, and then it kind of took on a life of its own.
I think you forgot like a really key element of the Hellraiser films, which is that it's all based around a Rubik's Cube.
That's true.
And puzzle box.
And that literally, I mean, and then they have to go to all these lengths basically to justify this, because basically if you
everybody you have to like engage with it.
Right. So if you just, if you see the Lemarchand
puzzle box
and you just walk away, you're fine. Literally, like you are not a character in Hellraiser.
You can hold it and pick it up, you know.
Or you just don't, well the thing is, it's implied that if as soon as you start trying to solve it, then you like this, it casts the spell on you and you will solve it, and then you're in a lot of trouble.
Then the hooks come out.
And your skin will probably get ripped off, which you might like 10%, but 90% you'll probably really dislike.
Yeah.
But like if you just walk away, if you see the box, just walk away, probably going to be okay.
What's your take on the second one? Because I feel like right until the end, it's not a bad movie.
Yeah, no, I think that I think that each of them is slightly worse than the one, or there's varying levels of dropouts, but the second one is not as good as the first, but is actually, I think, because it did have a bigger budget because of the success of the first, and
had a bigger budget, but it's also because it mostly, or a big chunk of it takes place in hell, and it's like clearly all of hell is just a terribly painted backdrop.
I love that painting. I think it's an amazing sort of Escher-esque kind of like,
but it's clearly matte painting. Standing in front of a wall.
Right, sure. It is also, as I recall, even gorier than the first one. I mean, the first one I've seen many times. The second one I've probably seen once or twice. The first one is quite gory, and like you definitely, if you want to like just have somebody who's like interested in horror and really wants something that is not genuinely upsetting, but definitely like kind of goes to some pretty extreme places, it's a good movie to watch. Like if you want to see somebody, like if you have a friend who wants to see someone torn apart, like literally torn apart by chains, that Hellraiser is a good movie to watch. From what I remember, Hellbound, Hellraiser 2 is even gorier.
I mean they dive into it a little bit. I mean it's interesting. It plays on that horror movie trope of the silent, like, genius child.
Yeah.
You know, she's like in an asylum and like she's like the expert puzzle box solver. So she's kind of the main character, and they do spend a lot of time in hell. And then I don't care if I spoil the movie at this point.
I think it's fine. I mean, these are also not plot driven movies.
Yeah, but you're right. It does get really good. There's the scenes with the doctors, which are there's a scene where so the mother from the first one returns with the second one, and she comes out of a bed. That's all I'll say about it, but it is easily one of the most unsettling things I've ever seen on film, that specific scene.
Well, I think also because one of the other things, again, not because I am kind of I had a period where I was really into Clive Barker, like all, you know, awkward teenage boys. Is that the things that are the most upsetting are not necessarily the most spectacularly gory, but the things that are
pretty gory,
right? But that also have like, because it starts with you can imagine some of these things happening to you,
But this is like maybe like aside from Dead Alive or maybe Evil Dead, this was the most blood I've seen in a single scene.
Right, but that the thing, the implement that isn't like chains coming out. I mean, it's basically a guy who is, if I recall correctly, he's like a guy who's convinced that he's covered in like bugs or something, right? And they give him a razor.
Oh, well, there's that scene too, but there's a scene because this is just calories are talking now. Basically, in the first one, the mother is bringing back her ex-lover by feeding him blood.
Right.
And in the second scene, there's a...
In a way that's never explained. Never clear why this works, but...
No, or why she's into it, or like she's...
I mean, she's into it because he spanked her.
Fair.
Yeah, and...
But in the second one, there's... And this is... This bugged me more than anything else in these movies and anything else in most movies that I've seen. There's these two doctors in the second one, and there's a scene where there's this bloody bed... And like the mother from the first one comes out, and she's just basically like a muscle monster,
right?
And the entire room gets smeared in blood, and it just really, really got me.
Okay, but But that, and I mean, now we're just trying to remember the plot of Hellbound.
Yeah,
but
this is also fun.
But isn't it the reason she comes out? The reason that she can come back is basically because they give this this guy who's like has these delusions about like bugs on his arm a razor, and so that's why he basically just slashes up his. And I remember that being one of the most upsetting things I've ever seen in a movie.
It really is just sort of back to back. And anyway, it falls apart at the end when the doctor becomes a Cenobite, and then it just becomes sort of like a silly romp.
I don't know if I'd go that far, but yes, it's not as scary then. It's
but
just,
number three is great for art lovers.
Number three is great if you've ever wanted to see a nightclub full of douchebags like completely destroyed by demons, including one guy who's like he's a DJ and CDs just get embedded into his head, and they start shooting out CDs from like a gun. On that note, thanks for listening to Original Content, and Brian, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Anthony. Don't worry, Dara will be back soon.
Yes, from Japanese time.